The Catholic Channel Sirius XM 129 presents Just Love with your host, Monsignor Kevin Sullivan, Executive Director of Catholic Charities of the Archdiocese of New York.
Welcome to Just Love. This is Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is our weekly conversation about the church in the world. And we talk about the variety of stuff that is going on in the world. And sometimes we talk about how the microphones don't work and the earphones overpower our ears. And so that's what we're about talking about right now. Anyway, but thanks for being with us. We're in the middle of summer. And we are we're kind of getting wrapping up towards the end of summer. A number of people this past week have said to me that summer goes by so fast, and I think that's absolutely true. We are in the middle of summer, and this past week, I think this is what I call kind of the unfortunate Catholic killjoy part of summer. Okay. So here's why I call it that, okay? Okay, because the past week, I mean, they have this holy day of obligation
right.
in it. You know, the Feast of the Assumption.
Right.
And like, you know, you got to go to Mass in the middle of the week.
Yeah.
But like, you know, and I got to tell you, I mean, listen, we have the Immaculate Conception, mm-hmm. right? Really big, really important. Mm-hmm. We have the birth of Mary on September 8th. Mm-hmm. And then we have kind of Mary, the Mother of God, which we celebrate on January 1st, right? Mm-hmm. We got a lot of Mary stuff.
We do. And then there's like the other ones like Guadalupe and stuff that aren't.
Yeah, but then we got this one.
Yeah.
In the middle of August, where we got to, you know, not go to the beach and
yeah.
not go, and we got to go to, I don't know. I think they just want us to feel guilty.
Well, I think that, you know, a way to get around that is you go to Mass in the morning, and then you could do everything else during the day.
Yeah. Okay.
If you wake up that early, I don't. I'm just saying that's a possibility.
I did this week. I celebrated the Mass mm-hmm. at 7:45 in the morning. Mm-hmm. And so I did it, but I still think, I don't know. You know what I think we should lobby for, okay?
Mm-hmm.
How about we lobby for an option?
Okay.
So you could go to Mass, you could make September 8th the holy day of obligation for Mary.
Right.
So for her birthday.
Yeah.
And that way, if you want to kind of just take August off.
Yeah.
You could.
That makes sense. You know why? Because if you celebrate her birthday, then you're celebrating her entire life. So
right.
it's just like.
Yeah, and this
takes
one
takes over everything else.
This one, so but here's a little trick on the a trick question on the mystery of the Assumption mm-hmm. of Mary. What? So tell me what we celebrate in the Feast of the Assumption of Mary. Do you know?
That she goes up into heaven, basically, like
you and I.
No. She went full body. Everything.
Everything.
Yes.
So, but here's the trick question.
Yeah.
The trick question. After she died?
Well, that's the part that I don't know.
Okay.
Because no one... Well, let me not sound stupid on Sirius XM.
Go ahead.
Well... That's what I don't know, because, you know, there's always this kind of mystery around what really happened to her. And we obviously don't have her body. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
So here's the technical.
Okay.
The technical ambiguity.
Right.
Okay. So it was defined as a dogma of the church.
Right.
That Mary, at the end of her earthly life. Mm-hmm. Went to heaven, body, soul, wasn't all of that. So
right.
that's our belief. But they were absolutely neutral on whether she died and then immediately went up.
Okay.
Or she went up before she died. So you can believe either one.
Wait.
Yep.
We have to talk about this now. If she went up like right before she died, that means that technically she was still alive, right?
Yeah, so at the end of her earthly life.
Right.
No longer on earth, she went to her heavenly life.
That's pretty insane. You just blew my mind.
Yep. But that's but or You can also believe that she went poop.
Right.
And right then away. Right away.
Right.
Right away. So okay. Because they didn't, you know, they didn't want to like box you in.
Right.
So.
Well, I'm going to go with the concept that blew my mind because that one's better.
You like that one
yeah,
better?
I do. Yeah. That one's cooler.
Okay. So anyway. But, you know, we're going to have a conversation now with Professor Drinan, Professor Kara Drinan, who is at Catholic University at the law school there. And we're going to talk about capital punishment. Now, with Professor Drinan, who is a law professor, we're going to talk about the broad issues of capital punishment in legal systems and how that plays itself out in criminal law. But we're doing it because within the past couple of weeks, there was a development in our church teaching with regard to that. And, you know, a lot of people made a big deal about it. And I think it is a big deal, but they made a big deal because the Pope changed the wording on what our Catholic belief is about capital punishment. And if I can do it in a way which is whatever, is very simplistic. So my disclaimer is this is very simplistic. There was kind of growing statements by the popes in the catechism which says, capital punishment, not such a good idea. Capital punishment, very bad idea. Capital punishment, really bad idea. Only in some really extreme situations. And then Pope Francis says, no way. Inadmissible. And so that kind of was perceived to be a kind of a big development and a big change. Now, please, anybody wants to call in, you can call in. Tell me it was grossly simplistic the way I described that. It was, but it's not too inaccurate as to we had a growing movement, say, less and less doing the death penalty. And then Pope Francis kind of takes it another step further and says, inadmissible, and doesn't articulate any exceptions to that in the way that it's phrased. So having said that, that's the lead up as to why we're going to have a conversation with Professor Kara Drinan, who is a professor of law at Catholic University of America. Professor Drinan, thanks so much for taking the time to be with us in the middle of summer to talk about this important topic. Thanks for being with us on Just Love.
Thanks so much for having me. My pleasure.
Great. Now, are you actually in Washington, D.C.?
The Catholic University is in Northeast Washington, D.C. That's correct.
Okay, and that's where you are? Because supposedly people who are in Washington, D.C. for August, they get extra credit for putting up with the summers in August.
Well, I'll take any extra credit I'm getting for surviving this humidity.
So. Okay. Yeah, I mean, I do like American history, and when I've read some of the history books about kind of the 19th century scenes in Washington, like everybody got out of town in August because they just couldn't deal with the humidity, the swamps, and all of that type of stuff. So you get your extra credit for hanging out in Washington.
Thank you.
So listen, I know you're not a theologian, but you look at criminal law and you look at this stuff, and you know, a big deal was made about, you know, the new wording that Pope Francis introduced in describing what the Catholic Church's teaching is on capital punishment. But could you give us a little bit of a perspective as what's kind of going on in criminal law? Because, you know, I mean, I'll just throw out some topics which I don't know much about, but I read about them like, well, it's cruel and unusual because this drug doesn't kill you quick enough. Then we get somebody staying it in one other place. Then I hear that foreign countries aren't extraditing people to the United States unless you take capital punishment off the table. So give us a little lay of the land in terms of what's going on with capital punishment in the United States at the moment.
Sure. So the first thing is just to think about when we talk about execution, typically in the criminal space, we talk about executions in the United States in the modern era, meaning after 1976.
You may remember
in the early 70s, there was sort of a brief hiatus on executions in this country when the Supreme Court told the states that their statutes essentially weren't narrowing the cases in which the death penalty was appropriate. So we had this brief hiatus. By 1976, states had corrected those statutes, if you will, to satisfy the Supreme Court. And so since 1976, there have been almost 1,500 executions in the entire country.
So, Professor Droney, let me ask you this question, because this is new information to me. What was the basis, I guess constitutionally, that the Supreme Court said your statutes are too broad? Is there something which says you can't have broad statutes for capital punishment?
Sure. So that you referred to the cruel and unusual punishment language, which is in the Eighth Amendment.
Okay.
The United States Constitution, and it bars punishments that are cruel and unusual, as the language suggests. And the way in which, one of the ways in which the court has interpreted that is to mean that it cannot be arbitrary, right?
Okay.
Getting a jury to say that one is going to be executed should not be, for example, the same thing as being struck by lightning.
Right.
So says the court, that there should be guided discretion. And so, yes, the court did say there have to be narrow circumstances and there has to be some principled reason for subjecting someone to the death penalty.
Now, again, from a non-legal point of view, does this have anything to do with kind of the phrase that we hear, the punishment should fit the crime?
Absolutely. Right. So that's really the principle in the legal world. We refer to that as the principle of proportionality. Right. The punishment should fit the crime.
And also they use the same term in moral theology.
OK, great. So that's and it's a really important principle, especially in the capital punishment arena, because the Supreme Court, for example, has said that one can only be executed for a homicide crime.
Oh.
And that's important, right? That there are other crimes, for example, heinous crimes. The rape of a child, for example, the Supreme Court has said even when the defendant is convicted of that crime, that is not a capital crime in the
Okay. It makes sense, but like I said, I am delighted that you're making me smarter, which is not too difficult, beginning where I begin from, but you're making our listeners smarter. So let's now talk about the modern era. What happens after 76?
Right. So since 1976, as I said, there have been almost 1,500 executions in this country. But I think what's most notable is that we, as a nation, we hit our peak in terms of annual executions in 1999.
Right.
And every year since then, we've been going down. The trend is definitely down. And so, for example, 1999, that year we had 98 executions. In 2017, we had 23. So that's a significant decline. It's also the case that juries are handing down fewer death sentences. Juries are just less comfortable doing that. And I would say the last important piece of evidence that suggests this downward trend is that the executions that are still happening are very geographically concentrated, right? So for example, last year in 2017, half of all the executions that happened in this country took place in three states, Texas, Virginia, and Florida. So that tells us that just as a country, we're moving away from the use of this punishment, and it's becoming very geographically concentrated. It's just a handful of states where voters are still really inclined to support this.
You know, again, we're speaking with Professor Kara Drinan, who is a professor of law at Catholic University. We're speaking about capital punishment, the death penalty, in light of some of the recent development in language in the Catholic Church about the admissibility, inadmissibility of the death penalty. That is very intriguing to me that it is concentrated. It didn't come as a great surprise to me. Am I right to say that in terms of meeting the criteria for the Supreme Court saying how you could do it, even though states have to meet that criteria, they just figure out a way to meet it?
I think you're speaking of the actual method of execution. Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm just talking about the reality.
Yeah. So The Supreme Court in recent years, beginning in about 2008, started looking at the constitutionality of lethal injection protocols, right? So the lethal injection is the dominant method of execution right. in this country. Again, referring to that Eighth Amendment language we spoke of before, the Eighth Amendment bars the state from using methods that are cruel and unusual, which essentially means that the state cannot inflict gratuitous pain.
Right.
It has to be pain that is necessary to accomplish the death. And as gruesome as that sounds, you know, you referred to this earlier, Monsignor. You've seen in the news litigation headlines about litigation challenging really two things. One is challenges that say, what are the drugs being used to achieve this killing? And the states often are not transparent about that. And the second is an argument that this cocktail of drugs being used, that they do in fact inflict pain and in some cases torture upon individuals as part of the execution. So the court has been monitoring that, but has been pretty reluctant to strike down even methods of execution that are surrounded in mystery.
So again, you know, I want to ask you the next question in a way which is not flip, because taking of human life is it, but isn't a firing squad the least painful?
So it's really interesting that you say that. There are legal scholars who have argued that we should return to the firing squad, and that is possibly the most humane method of execution. There are a number of methods of execution that are still technically on the books in some states. So I mentioned lethal injection because that's the method that states and the federal government dominantly use. But many states still have an electric chair, gas chamber, hanging, firing squad are still on the books. And you're right. I mean, there is an argument that that's a potentially more humane way, that it's faster, that it's guaranteed, right? Whereas these drug protocols are often unpredictable. I personally think the reason that states have not returned to that method as a way of avoiding this litigation is that optically, I mean, imagine what that would look like as a headline, right? When an individual thinks of a firing squad, I think they think of authoritarian regimes with individuals being lined up and killed. And I frankly think that states are uncomfortable with that.
And you're not talking, I mean, you're not making a political statement about the current administration, right?
I wasn't.
Okay,
but
fine.
I could see how one would go there.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure that we didn't have our listeners misunderstand what we were talking about. But I became enthralled in the past year by watching The Tudors, the historical thing, and oh my God, the executioner with the axe, that was like, wow, that was really, and I mean, the one part which I mean, it was bizarre that Henry, I don't know who it was it whether it was Anne Boleyn, one of his wives, he gave her the great privilege of getting the most elegant, qualified, skilled executioner from France. And they had to postpone it for a day because he couldn't cross the English Channel from France. Because, again, going back and now a little more serious with the cruel and unusual, if you had a bad executioner, it sometimes took a lot of swipes of the axe to actually do it. But if you have a good one, it was one quick swipe. So, I mean, it's like you say, the pictures can be really, really gruesome with regard to it. So it's really an icky. I mean, it's you know, again, I've always thought, this is my own personal opinion, that, you know, I think the movement against capital punishment, I mean, I just don't see it as a state using its power to inflict punishment that way. So, but whatever. But some of the pictures are just gruesome in the way it works out.
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the reasons. I mean, there are several. Hopefully we can talk about the trend away from the death penalty. But there are several reasons. And one of them is just this public sense of discomfort is obviously too small of a word, but this public discomfort with participation in a state organized
right.
killing that happens in such a calm, calculated way.
Yeah, I mean, I have often jokingly said in situations is I have a great deal more openness to vigilantism than I do to capital punishment. Vigilantism isn't the state organized way of doing it. It's kind of an individual outrage, which isn't good, but it's different than when the whole power of the state is coming to bear in taking human life. And admittedly, assuming you get the conviction correctly, it's not technically innocent human life, but it's still the taking of human life.
Yes, it is that. And I would say, too, interestingly, in the criminal law, we distinguish between murders that are done in a very cool, detached, and premeditated way.
Ah.
That's typically a first-degree murder, the most serious, from those that are done, for example, in the heat of passion. And that's consistent with what you just said, right? I mean, as human beings, we can understand a parent reacting to the victimization of their child or so forth, but it's harder to understand state actors over a series of years with cool minds deciding to do this.
And again, while I do think the following is very relevant, although very relevant, I mean, I have never seen, and maybe I'm just not knowledgeable about this, but I haven't seen any evidence that states that have the death penalty, states that don't have the death penalty, that it deters capital crimes.
Well, there's lots of evidence. Unfortunately, it does not support capital punishment.
Right.
So the social scientists have universally demonstrated that the deterrence argument for having capital punishment is a false one. So if you look at, you know, I mentioned that executions have gone down since 2000 in this country.
Right.
Well, so too has the national homicide rate.
Right.
If you look at the South accounts for 80% of executions nationwide, and that region has the highest murder rate. So the evidence suggests otherwise, right? It does not suggest that there are fewer killings in regions where they have a robust death penalty.
So give us a little sense of what's going on to the extent you can, in the entire world. We're talking about the United States, the fact that the number of death penalties inflicted has been going down. We always hear, I think, that Western Europe has very few, or they don't have any there. What about the rest of the world?
Right. So the Death Penalty Information Center is a great resource and tracks this kind of information. And 95% of all known executions are carried out by six countries. So obviously I say that because there may be things happening that are not documented. But those six countries, unfortunately, are the United States, China, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, and Iraq. So those are not nations.
That's probably not the group you want to invite to a fun party.
Exactly. Those are not nations to whom we look for best practices in any other realm of government.
Right. Yeah. So that is intriguing. That is intriguing. So I mean, again, we talked about the movement in with kind of growing Catholic Church species. So I'm just going to ask you to speculate as somebody teaching at Catholic University, Catholic, do you think any impact of kind of the gradual but steady kind of, to use a benign word, decreasing enthusiasm for the legitimacy of the death penalty in Catholic teaching with the trend in the country? Speculate. Any correlation or causality?
Are you asking me going forward whether I think...
Well, no. I mean to now, because there's been a growing... this is just the last kind of domino that falls with Pope Francis. I mean, Pope John the Second, John Paul II, he gradually moved further and further away from a broad legitimacy for that. So
Yeah, I mean, it could be that. This is what I would say. It could be that I'm disappointed as a practicing Catholic. I'm disappointed that I read polls suggesting that more than 50% of Catholics support the death penalty today. So I don't know, honestly, that we can attribute this movement to the church's position. I can only hope that the new language will help this momentum. But honestly, I think it's related to other variables. I think it's related to cost. The death penalty is incredibly expensive. There are lots of studies that document its expense. I already mentioned the fact that we know it's not a deterrent. And we have not talked about what I think are really the two key reasons people are unsatisfied with it. And that is, we have had more than 160 exonerations from death row.
Right.
And so people know that the system gets it wrong.
Right.
And I also think there's a growing awareness in this country that our criminal justice system is fundamentally unfair to poor people and to people of color, and that is also true on death row.
Yeah. I would, you know, Professor Duran and I think, again, my intuition tells me that you are right, that even, and again, we're so divided as a country on a lot of public policy issues that what you're looking for is a 5% to 10% swing of the people who haven't made their minds up. So you're looking at that middle group. And I think that while those on extremes are not going to be swayed by a lot of evidence, whatever the evidence is, those people in the middle, I think the two items that you just mentioned have been critical, that we get it wrong more than a few times. We need more than our fingers and toes to count the number of times we get it wrong, and that it does depend. If you got some money, you get a good lawyer, and you have more money, and if your skin color tends to be lighter, the odds on it being for you is less. And I think you're right. Those are critically probably important factors in why we're moving away from it. So, Professor Drinan, any one final point? You've been generous with your time, and I know it's humid and muggy, but any final point you want to share with our listeners?
I would just say that the one thing I had hoped we could touch on is that Pope Francis has also really condemned the use of life without parole in this country and has called
it a
death penalty in disguise. And I think that's a really important point because, from my perspective,
right,
life without parole is not a moral alternative to capital punishment. And unfortunately, it's often put forward as the next best alternative. And I think it too is deeply problematic.
So what would you do?
I think as a nation, we over-incarcerate. We send too many people to prison for too long. Life without parole, you know, the Pope is right to call it a death penalty in disguise. There may be a rare case or cases where that is an appropriate sentence, but we have more than 50,000 Americans serving that sentence.
But again, I'm not a lawyer. But when everybody talks about, you know, the leniency of the criminal justice system, people get out, revolving, all of that type of stuff. When we hear about sentences and stuff like that, does it really mean without parole?
It absolutely means that. I'm glad you said that.
Right.
In the late 20th century, most states in this country narrowed, if not abolished, parole. So life without parole sentence means a person will die in the custody of the state.
Okay. All right. And I tend to agree with, you know what I think about it then, and this might be a little bit bizarre, but can you imagine having to be a corrections officer guarding people who, without parole? I mean, what's their incentive to do anything? It's really is an awful, awful situation. So I think I thank you so much for bringing that up. I think that's absolutely critical. So listen, thanks so much for being with us, and enjoy Washington in the summer.
Likewise.
Professor Kara Drinan, professor of law at Catholic University of America, who we talked about the death penalty, the growing disuse of it in the United States in light of Pope Francis's, we talked about it in light of his teaching. Let's take a break. When we come back on the Catholic Channel on Just Love, just do it. Just love God, just love your neighbor, and our world will be more just and will be more compassionate. This is the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Now, let's get back to Just Love and your host, Monsignor Kevin Sullivan.
Welcome back to Just Love. Thanks for being with us. This is our week of the Feast of the Assumption, that feast this past week, which I kind of think that is a little killjoy because they want to make sure we go to church in the middle of the summer. I'd like to substitute the Nativity of Mary on September 8th for this, and then we could take all of August off except for Sundays because we got to go on Sundays. But anyway, so, hey, Jake. So I hear that in light of our conversation about the capital punishment and the death penalty, you prefer that when you commit your crime in place of life without parole?
Hypothetically speaking, and I can't say that loud enough. Yes. I'm taking the hot shot. Uh-huh. I would rather take that than life in prison. Absolutely.
So you agree with Pope Francis that's kind of really a bad thing. It's like capital punishment.
I mean, I agree with him in that we overuse it too much. That being said, in extreme cases, like, If it's Jeffrey Dahmer or somebody, yeah, I don't want him to be my neighbor ever.
I'm talking about what Pope Francis says is life without parole.
Yes.
Is kind of like capital.
It is. It's like the slowest form of capital punishment. To me, that is basically a 60-year crucifixion, in a way.
So I have a suggestion for you, Jake.
Yeah.
Be good.
I'll try.
Hey, Fanny, it's now about 4 years after ISIS took over Mosul, and about 100,000 Christians fled overnight from the plains of Nineveh, which is right outside of Mosul. So what's happening now 4 years later?
Yeah, so it happens on August 6th,
right?
In 2014,
the Feast of the Transfiguration, which again, we don't have make that a holy day, so I think we should get some options.
And that's Jesus.
Right.
So what's happening there is that, so first of all, the Chaldean Archbishop Bashar Warda, he welcomed all of these refugees who came in. But he's currently in the process of building a new hospital there that will serve all religions and which will feature ongoing formation for new graduates and exchange programs, allowing doctors and nurses to travel abroad. So he's creating these programs for people to for Christians to help other people who need it, refugees and such. Two gentlemen, Rassam and Raphael, both 25 years old, they are members of a local fellowship community founded by Warda in 2011 and have extensive experience running programs for refugees and those who are displaced by ISIS. So Rassam specifically is a computer engineer, and he basically is one of the people who was tasked with creating a database of all of the thousands of displaced fleeing refugees fleeing ISIS. So they show up at a church, and he basically takes their name down, gives them food. So there's this team of people that do this. And also organizations such as Aid to the Church in Need and Knights of Columbus decided to launch the housing project, which is called the Nineveh Plains Reconstruction Project, organized and led by local churches on the ground and aimed to rebuild Christian villages destroyed by ISIS. So there's, there's a lot of Christian help there. These people are kind of building up, becoming pillars. And, though many are still there, people are either, the ones whose houses are completely burned, or they have enough money to continue renting while waiting for the situation at home to stabilize. But the number of people who are returning is growing. And because there is no point in staying there, it's either you go to your home country, or you have that option now. You can go back. It's getting better.
Okay, so let's set the stage for our listeners, Fanny. 4 years mm-hmm. later, so you had almost overnight, 100,000 people are driven out
right.
of their homes,
right.
probably about 60, 80 miles away. So you know, wherever you are in the country, think if you're in a main city and you got to go 60 miles away, so whatever, overnight, kind of, they're driven around. Mm-hmm. So this new place, Erbil, which is about 60 or so miles away from Mosul, or the plains of Nineveh, Karakosh, actually. So the new bishop, there is very welcoming.
Yes.
And he's kind of says, you're here, we're welcoming you into our church, and do that. Now, but the people there, they're kind of displaced. They want to go back.
Yes.
So right now, 4 years later, you have a situation in which some are still staying because, unfortunately, a lot of their houses were destroyed mm-hmm. back where they were, and some are going back. So it's now kind of a situation where it's a little bit ambiguous because the 100,000 are in different places, because there's also a bunch, I don't know the exact numbers, who didn't stay in Erbil in northern Iraq, Kurdistan, but just went to other places, whether right. they be Jews. And a few probably came to the United States because some family. So it's a situation we want to continue to follow. So, Fanny, I'm getting a little hungry. And in the light of all this serious conversation, what's going on in the cookie world?
So I don't know if you guys like love Girl Scout cookies, but I definitely do. I love them.
Jake, you like Girl Scout cookies?
Absolutely.
Which ones?
I like the, is it the samosa one? Yes, with the coconuts.
Yeah, that's
yes,
my favorite.
Absolutely.
Favorite. All right, but so what we got? What do we got going on with Girl
so
Scout?
So starting January 2nd, which is actually the launch of the official season, like that's when they start.
Next year or past
this
year?
One coming up.
Oh, so this is a preview for our listeners.
Yes.
Okay, so what's
so
the
watch
preview?
Out for this, guys. Okay. So they're launching a new caramel chocolate chip cookie. It's going to be available across the country, so everywhere.
Okay.
I'm talking, you know, because in Jersey, we always have to come to New York for stuff because it's a bigger city.
So, but now, but here's my question with chocolate chip cookies, because mm-hmm. I really think you got this issue with chocolate chip cookies. Like, you got the softies,
right.
like the chewy, and then you got the hard...
The crunchies. Yeah.
So is this a softy or a crunchy?
So this is a chewy cookie, which is the best. You don't... What? You don't like chewy cookies?
I like the hard ones.
Oh, no. This is going to be great. You're going to love it. This is what they say. They describe it wonderfully.
Are you a flack for the Girl Scout cookie business?
I should just be a promoter, right?
I should
just promote them. Okay, so the chewy cookie is made with caramel semi-sweet chocolate chips and boasts in a hint of sea salt in every bite.
All right, so here's
that
the deal.
That sounds amazing.
So here's the deal. Here's the deal. You got to buy us some.
Okay.
And we'll have a taste test.
Okay.
In here. And Tom, you got to bring your favorite chocolate chip cookie too, and we'll taste test between your favorite
okay.
and Fanny's, and we'll figure out who's going to be. Are you in, Jake? You're in this competition?
Absolutely.
Okay, so actually, they can bring them in, and we'll be the judges.
Sounds good.
Okay,
that's
a
deal. Okay, let's take a break because I got to meditate on this chewy. I like the crunchies. I like the crunchies and thick.
Maybe we should bring in chewy and crunchy cookies then.
Well, that's up to Tom. We'll let
Tom.
Him do. Okay.
So yes.
Anyway, but anyway, so let's take a break. This is Just Love, Just Do It. Just love God, just love your neighbor, just love yourself, and our world will be more just and more compassionate. We'll be back in just a moment, and we're going to talk about the family in light of Pope Francis's trip to Ireland to celebrate the family event in Ireland. So we'll be back in just a moment on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Just do it. Just love. Just check out Monsignor Kevin Sullivan, who's here right now. Take it away, Monsignor.
Welcome back to Just Love. We're going to be talking in this segment about the family, and families need nourishment and they need drink. So we're going to talk about, in January, we're going to talk about samosas, mimosas, samoras, and what else are we talking about, friend? What's the other one?
It's actually Samoa.
Samoa is the cookie.
Yes.
But what's the thing you do on the fire?
The thing I do on the fire?
No, like the marshmallow.
Oh, the s'mores.
S'mores.
The s'mores. Yeah. Those are very good also.
Don't like them.
But we can't do a fire in here. I just want to bring all the cookies into
so
the studio.
So remember what I said before? We can't get permission for doing a fire in here.
Right.
But we can get forgiven.
That's true.
Because you know what we'll do? Brett is with us in the studio today. And you know what we're going to do? We're going to get Brett to bring Father Dave Dwyer in, so we can go to confession after we do our fire.
Okay.
And
I'm good with that.
He can forgive us for doing the fire.
Okay.
That's here. All right. So anyway, listen, Pope Francis is going to Ireland, and he's going there because there is the World Meeting of Families. Also this past week, in addition to the Feast of the Assumption, we also celebrate the Feast of St. Maximilian Kolbe, who was a Polish priest. Franny, tell us a little bit why he was made a priest. Give us just a brief thumbnail, because it's going to be very important when we talk to our next guest, Brady Fun, who works with us at Feeding Our Neighbor. And so tell us about why the church made Maximilian Kolbe a saint.
Sure. So he's was a Franciscan friar, and he worked in his monastery providing shelter for refugees first. That included about 2,000 Jews who he hid during World War II. And so towards his time in the concentration camp in Auschwitz, the second month there were men who were being put to death by starvation. And there was one father who had a family. I believe he was in the concentration camp with a few of his sons. And he volunteered to take his place so that the father would live. So that's honestly what he's known for, is that he volunteered his life to take the place of this father so that he can be with his children. And, you know, then Maximilian Kolbe was put to death.
That certainly is imitation of what Jesus says, to give, to sacrifice for others, love for one another.
Right.
Brady Fun, thank you for being with us on Just Love. And Brady, in addition to kind of directing our Catholic charity emergency food programs, is also a pastor of a parish in Harlem. Brady, what I want to talk to you a little bit about is, I know we deal with a lot of single individuals, some elderly at our food programs, but we provide food every week at our food programs to both working families and families who maybe aren't working. So give us a little sense about what you pick up about the families who are coming to our emergency food programs. Give us a little bit about what you see in them.
Sure. And Monsignor Sullivan, thank you for the invitation to your show. What's interesting is that we're realizing that it's not just about homeless anymore. I think the world knows that, but I think the staff, the internal staff, is figuring out that you have those who are working. You have those who are retired. A gentleman said to me that he never saw himself retired from a good state job. And he was a little embarrassed. He came 5 to 7 for the work. Those who, because he thought if he came earlier, he would have been recognized. And one of the things he said is, he said, Brady, I never thought that I would be on this line. The issue of hunger is across the board now. Folks are working, folks are making decisions, whether they're going to buy medication, or food. Folks are deciding which child is going to eat tonight. This is a really, really serious issue. And I think that we're realizing that this is more serious than we had than we thought it was.
So we talk about this, and obviously in Catholic Charities, we serve people of all religions. We try to treat everybody with dignity and respect. And realistically, we know that our brothers and sisters, made in God's image and likeness, you know, are struggling with a variety of things. And there are, I mean, there are a number of people who we help on a regular basis who may have some emotional problems. They may have some addiction problems that we're dealing with. But I think I hear a little bit what you're saying. There are a number of people who, and I'm going to use a word, okay, who are quote-unquote normal.
Right.
Maybe normal families, they just don't have enough money, and they come into our food programs also.
Right. No, you're right, Monsignor. I mean, it's everyone. Those who are making $40,000, $50,000 a year, they're online as well. And I think that we have to change the mindset of those who are serving them. What's interesting, Monsignor, you talk about using the word normal. It's also those who are working with us.
Right.
I preached a sermon about hunger insecurity last year, and my organists, my officers, those in my congregation were almost in tears because they realized that they were also hunger insecure. It's hard, you know. I'm trying to let the parishes know, let the staff know that don't get excited because our numbers are growing.
Right.
It means that the issue is getting worse.
So let me shift the topic completely on this and say, let's not deal with food for a moment because, you know, from our Catholic, our Christian perspective, we believe that the family is critically important. We believe that that is the nurturing cell where an individual grows, they reach their human potential, the interaction between spouses, between children, that is how the human person grows. But the family's in trouble, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is in trouble on a few levels. I think one is that the fact that folks are, you know, one of our sites feed, 500 people a week. And what we're realizing is that most of those folks who are online have other family issues, whether it's unemployment, whether they don't have benefits, whether they're undocumented, you know, single family households. There are a lot of issues, you know, and what we try to instill in the staff is that it's not just that they're hungry, but there's a serious instability in their family.
So if you were given the task of writing the talk that Pope Francis is going to give at this World Meeting of Families, and don't say it's only about Ireland, but it's about the communities that you know, what would be the points that you would tell him to speak about in the talk he gave about the current state of world of families and what we need to do to better support families? What are his talking points?
I think one would be that the family is fractured. And not necessarily because of internal things that are happening within their family, but because of the world in terms of how we are supporting families, how we are giving to families. I think, too, is that never make the assumption that, you know, a family that has two parents and, two cars is a stable family. Everybody is struggling right now. You know, and three is that we need to look holistically in terms of how we can support the family beyond food.
So here's a dilemma that I want to posed to you, and because of your experience working with a lot of families, my experience has been that I have seen some of the best situations or the best families have been struggling single mothers who have really done such a job in taking care of their kids. Every one of them says to me, I wish I had a partner to make it better. So how do, and as you talked about, the number of children who are raised in single families, and even though sometimes it's not politically correct, all of the sociological data tells us, all things being equal, a child tends to develop better in a two-parent family. How do we kind of talk about that, encourage that, without stigmatizing and blaming parents who are struggling? How do we kind of do that?
That's a tough one.
Yeah, but that's why I invited you, because you're smart and bright and holy.
Right. That is a tough one. Someone who has grew up in a single parent household, single family. I was still had a relationship with my father, but it was my mom who raised me. One of the things that I was fortunate or blessed enough to have was mentors, where I had men in my life who were able to show me how to be a man, show me how to, starting with summer youth, working in the job and stuff. I mean, it's hard. I have a lot of those in my parish who are single parents. We continue to encourage. One of the things that I do is I try to help them get better jobs, but also try to galvanize the effort of men within the church and the community to help surround those families. It takes a village, and there are some that might never have a partner.
Right.
But, if we can just try to partner with them and, bring individuals into their lives that will help them with their kids.
Brady Funn, who is the director of our food programs at Catholic Charities, who is also a pastor of a parish in Harlem, thanks for being with us and sharing with us some of the struggles that our families are currently facing and some of the encouragement that we need to do and some of the supports we need to kind of put around our families in order to make sure that, the families can be that supportive things, even with the challenges that are currently faced. So, Brady, thank you for the work that you do, and thanks for joining us in studio here on Just Love.
Thank you, Monsignor.
So, Fanny, I'm looking forward to our January kind of cookie taste test.
Yes.
I'm glad we celebrated the Assumption this past week, and I'm glad we did, but I'm putting in my plug for we get the option of September to
let's
do
hope.
It. Let's hope. Let's hope. Hey, thanks for being with us on Just Love. Just do it. Love God, love your neighbor, love yourself. Our world will be more just and more compassionate. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Thanks for being with us. Join us again next week on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Listening to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.